pressed a button under his desk. Moments later, his secretary appeared with a pot of tea and a plate of Bath Oliver biscuits. The deputy commissioner followed in her wake.
"I thought it might be wise to have Anil Khan present for this meeting, H.H., as he will be taking over from me in a few weeks' time. I know of your reputation, of course," said Mr. Patel, shaking Khan warmly by the hand, "and I am delighted that you are able to join us."
Once the secretary had served the three men with tea, she left the room. The moment the door was closed, Commissioner Kumar dispensed with any more small talk.
"You asked to see me urgently, H.H., concerning a personal matter?"
"Yes," replied Patel.
"I thought you ought to know that I had a visit yesterday from someone who claims to work for you."
The commissioner raised an eyebrow.
"A Mr. Raj Malik. He is a junior filing clerk in a private capacity," he was at pains to emphasize.
The commissioner began tapping the armrest of his chair with the palm of his right hand as Patel continued.
"Malik said that you were in possession of a file that showed that I was under investigation for money laundering."
"You were, H.H.,"
said the commissioner with his usual candor.
"Following 9/11, the Minister of Internal Affairs instructed me to investigate any organization which dealt in large sums of cash. That included casinos, racetracks, and in your case, the Bank of Mumbai. A member of my team interviewed your chief teller and advised him about what he should be on the lookout for, and I personally signed the clearance certificate for your company."
"I remember. You briefed me at the time," said Patel. "But your fellow, Malik, he's not my fellow, said that he could arrange to have my file destroyed."
He paused.
"For a small consideration."
"He said what?"
said Kumar, almost exploding out of his chair.
"How small?"
asked Deputy Commissioner Khan calmly.
10 million rupees, replied Patel.
"H.H., I don't know what to say," said the commissioner.
"You don't have to say anything," said Patel, "because it never crossed my mind even for a moment that you could be involved in anything quite so stupid. And I told Malik as much."
"I am grateful," said the commissioner.
"No need to be," said Patel. "But I did think that perhaps others less charitable..."
He paused.
"Especially as Malik's visit came so close to your retirement..."
He hesitated again.
"And were the press to get hold of the story, it might so easily be misunderstood."
"I am grateful for your concern, and the speed with which you have acted," said Kumar. "I will remain eternally in your debt."
"I want nothing more than to be sure that this city rightly remains eternally in your debt," said Patel, "so that when you leave office it will be in a blaze of glory, rather than with question marks hanging over your head, which, as we both know, would linger on long after your retirement."
The deputy commissioner nodded his agreement as Patel rose from his place.
"You know, Naresh,"
Patel said, turning to face the commissioner,
"I would never have agreed to see the damned man if you had not spoken so highly of him in your speech to the Rotary Club last month. He even produced the article in the Mumbai Times. I therefore assumed that the fellow had come with your blessing."
Mr. Patel turned to face Khan.
"May I wish you luck when you take over as commissioner,"
he added, shaking hands with the deputy.
"I don't envy you having to follow such a fine man."
Kumar smiled for the first time that morning.
"I'll be back in a moment,"
the commissioner said to his deputy as he left his office to accompany Patel to the front door. The deputy commissioner stared out of the window as he waited for the chief to return. He munched on a biscuit as he mulled over several possible alternatives. By the time the commissioner walked back into the room, Khan knew exactly what had to be done. But would he be able to convince his boss this time?
"I'll have Malik arrested and behind bars within the hour,"
said the commissioner as he picked up the phone on his desk.
I wonder, sir,
said Deputy Khan quietly, if that's the best course of action given the circumstances?
I don't have much choice, said the Commissioner as he began dialing.
You may be right, said Khan, but before you make such an irrevocable decision, perhaps we should consider how this is all going to play. He paused. With the press?
They'll have a field day, said Kumar as he replaced the phone and began pacing around the room. They won't be able to make up their minds if I should be hanged as a crook who's willing to accept bribes, or dismissed as the most naive fool ever to hold the office of commissioner. Neither scenario bears thinking about.
But we have to think about it, insisted Deputy Khan, because your enemies, and even good men, have enemies, will happily settle for someone who's willing to take kickbacks, while your friends will not be able to deny the lesser charge of naivety.
But surely after 40 years of service, people will believe...
People will believe whatever they want to believe, said Khan, confirming the commissioner's worst fears. And certainly you won't be able to send Malik back to prison until he's been given the chance to appear in a witness box and tell the world his side of the story.
But who would believe that old...
No smoke without fire. They'll be whispering in the corridors of the law courts, and that will be tame compared with the headlines in the morning papers once Malik has spent a couple of days in the witness box being questioned by a friendly barrister who sees you as nothing more than a stepping stone in his career. Kumar continued to pace around the room but didn't respond. Let me try and second-guess the headlines that would follow such a cross-examination. Khan paused before saying, Commissioner accepts bribes to destroy friends' files. Might be the headline in the Times, while the tabloids will surely be a little more colourful. Bung money left in Commissioner's office by delivery boy. Or perhaps Commissioner Kumar employs ex-con to carry out his dirty work.
I think I've got the picture, said the Commissioner, as he sank back into the chair next to Khan. So what the hell am I supposed to do about it?
What you've always done in the past, Khan replied. Play it by the book. The commissioner looked across at his deputy quizzically. What do you have in mind?
Malik!
Shouted the supervisor at the top of his voice, even before he'd put the phone down.
Commissioner Kumar wants to see you immediately.
Did he say why? Asked Malik, nervously.
No, he's not in the habit of confiding in me, replied the supervisor. But don't hang about because he's not a man who likes to be kept waiting.
Yes, sir, Malik replied. He closed the file he'd been working on and placed it back on the supervisor's desk. He walked across to his locker, removed his bicycle clips, and left the building without another word. It wasn't until he was outside on the pavement that he began to shake. Had they caught on to his latest scam? Not that it had proved that successful. He unlocked the chain that was attached to the railings and began to consider his options. Should he make a run for it? Or simply try to brazen it out? He hadn't been left with a lot of choice. After all, where would he run to? And even if he did decide to run, it would only be a matter of days, perhaps hours, before they caught up with him. Malik slipped on his bicycle clips, mounted his third-hand Rally Lenten, and began to pedal slowly towards the city centre. The dusty brown roads were teeming with other bicycles, cars and countless numbers of people, all heading in different directions. The incessant honking of horns, the multitude of different smells, the beating down of the sun and the bustle of everyday life ensured that Mumbai was like no other city on earth. Street traders thrust out their arms as Malik passed, trying to sell him their wares, while beggars with no arms ran by his side, not assisting his progress. Should he come clean and admit what he'd been up to? He cycled for a few more yards. No, never admit to anything, a golden rule that he'd learnt after long years in prison. He swerved to avoid a cow and nearly fell off. Assume they know nothing until you're cornered. Even then, deny everything. As he rounded the next corner, police headquarters loomed up in front of him. If he was going to make a dash for it, it would have to be now or never. he pedalled on. Until he was only a few yards away from the steps leading up to the front entrance, he tugged firmly on the tired brake handles until his bike came to a slow, unsteady halt. He climbed off and padlocked his one asset to the nearest railing. He walked slowly up the steps to police headquarters, pushed his way through the swing doors, and headed nervously towards the reception desk. He told the duty officer his name. Perhaps there had been a mistake.
"I have an appointment with..." "Ah, yes,"
the duty officer replied ominously, without needing to consult his roster.
"The commissioner is waiting to see you. You'll find his office is on the 14th floor."
Malik turned and began walking towards the lifts, aware that the duty officer's eyes never left him. Malik glanced at the front door. This would be his last chance to escape, he thought, as the doors of one of the lifts slid open. He stepped into a crowded elevator, which made several stops on its slow, interrupted journey to the 14th floor. By the time Malik reached the top floor, he was sweating profusely, and it wasn't just the crowded space and lack of air conditioning that caused his unease. When the doors finally parted, he was on his own. Malik stepped out onto the only thickly carpeted corridor in the building. He looked around, and then recalled his last visit. He began to walk slowly towards an office at the far end of the corridor. The word "Commissioner" was printed in bold, stenciled letters on the door. Malik knocked quietly. Perhaps something more important had arisen, causing the commissioner to leave the office without warning. He heard a female voice invite him to enter. He opened the door, to find the commissioner's secretary seated behind her desk, tapping away furiously. She stopped typing the moment she saw Malik.
"The commissioner is expecting you,"
was all she offered. She didn't smile and she didn't frown as she rose from her place. Perhaps she was unaware of his fate. The secretary disappeared through another door and returned almost immediately.
"The commissioner will see you now, Mr. Malik," she said,
and held the door open for him. Malik walked into the commissioner's office to find him seated at his desk, eyes down, studying an open file. He raised his head, looked directly at him, and said,
"Have a seat, Malik."
Not Raj, not Mr., just Malik. Malik slipped into the chair opposite the commissioner. He sat in silence, trying not to appear nervous as he watched the second hand of the clock on the wall behind the desk complete a full minute.
"Malik,"
the commissioner eventually said as he looked up from the papers on his desk,
"I've just been reading your supervisor's annual report."
Malik remained silent, although he could feel a bead of sweat trickling down his nose. The commissioner looked back down again.
"He's very complimentary about your work," said Kumar. "Full of praise, far better than I could have hoped for when you sat in that chair just a year ago."
The commissioner looked up and smiled.
"In fact, he's recommending that you should be promoted."
"Promoted?"
said Malik in disbelief.
"Yes, though it may not prove that easy, as there are not too many appropriate jobs available at the present time. However, I do believe I have come across a position that is ideally suited for your particular talents."
"Oh, thank you, sir,"
said Malik, relaxing for the first time.
"There is a vacancy,"
the commissioner opened another file and smiled,
"for an assistant in the city morgue."
He extracted a single sheet of paper and began reading from it.
"It would be your responsibility to scrub the blood off the slabs and clean the floor immediately after the bodies have been dissected and stored away. Until the stench is not all that pleasant, but a face mask is supplied, and I have no doubt that in time one gets used to it."
He continued to smile at Malik.
"The appointment comes with the rank of sub-supervisor, along with a corresponding rise in salary. It also has other perks, not least that you would have your own room directly above the morgue, so you wouldn't have to bed down any longer at the YMCA.
The commissioner paused.
"And Should you continue to hold the post until your 60th birthday, you would also be entitled to a modest pension.
The commissioner closed Malik's file and looked directly at him.
Any questions?
He asked.
Only one, sir, said Malik. Is there any alternative?
Oh, yes, replied the commissioner. You can spend the rest of your life in jail.
XII. In the Eye of the Beholder. Other than the fact that they had been to school together, the two of them had little in common. Gian Lorenzo Vinici had been a diligent child since his first roll call at the age of 5, whereas Paolo Castelli somehow managed always to be late, even for his first roll call. Gian Lorenzo felt at home in the classroom with books, essays, and exams, where he outshone his contemporaries. Paolo achieved the same results on the football field, with a change of pace, a deceptive turn, and a shot at goal which beguiled his own team as well as the opposition. Both young men progressed to Santa Cecilia's, the most prestigious high school in Rome, where they were able to display their talents to a wider audience. When their school days were over, they both graduated to Roma, Gian Lorenzo to the nation's oldest university as a scholar, Paolo to the nation's oldest football club as a striker. Although they didn't mix in the same circles, they were both well aware of the other's achievements. While Gian Lorenzo collected honours in one field, Paolo won them on another, both achieving their goals. After leaving university, Gian Lorenzo joined his father at the Vinici Gallery. He immediately set about converting those years of study into something more practical, as he wished to emulate his father and become the most respected art dealer in Italy. By the time Gian Lorenzo had begun his apprenticeship, Paolo had been appointed captain of Roma. With the cheers and adulation of the fans ringing in his ears, he led them to championship and European glory. Gian Lorenzo only had to turn to the back pages of any newspaper on an almost daily basis to follow the exploits of his former classmate, and to the gossip columns to discover who was the latest beauty to be found dangling from his arm, another difference between them. Gian Lorenzo quickly discovered that in his chosen profession, long-term reputation would be built not on the occasional inspired goal, but on hours of dedicated research combined with good judgment. He had inherited from his father the two most important gifts in any art dealer's armory, a good eye and a good nose. Antonio Vinici also taught his son not only how to look, but where to look when searching for a masterpiece. The old man only dealt in the finest examples of Renaissance painting and sculpture, which would never appear on the open market. Unless a piece was exclusive, Antonio didn't venture out of his gallery. His son followed in his footsteps. The gallery bought and sold only 3, perhaps 4 paintings a year, but those masters changed hands at around the same price as one of Roma's strikers. After 40 years in the business, Gian Lorenzo's father knew not only who possessed the great collections, but more important, who might be willing, or better still, needed to part with the occasional masterpiece. Gian Lorenzo became so engrossed in his work that he missed the injury Paolo Castelli sustained while playing for Italy against Spain in the European Cup. This personal setback placed Paolo on the sidelines of the football field, as well as the newspapers, especially when it became clear that he had reached his sell-by date. Paolo left the world stage just as Gian Lorenzo strode onto it. He began to travel around Europe, representing the gallery in an endless quest to seek out only the rarest examples of genius, and, having acquired a masterpiece, to find someone who could afford to purchase it. Gian Lorenzo often wondered what had become of Paolo since he'd stopped playing football and the press no longer reported his every move. He was to discover overnight when Paolo announced his engagement. Paolo's choice of marriage partner ensured that his exploits were transferred from the back pages to the front. Angelina Porcelli was the only daughter of Massimo Porcelli, president of Roma Football Club and chairman of Ulitox, the largest pharmaceutical company in Italy. A marriage of two heavyweights, declared the banner headline in one of the tabloids. Gian Lorenzo turned to page 3 to discover what merited such a comment. Paolo's bride-to-be was 6'2", an advantage for a model, I hear you say, but there the comparison ended, because the other vital statistic the reporters latched onto was Angelina's weight. This seemed to vary between 300 and 350 pounds, according to whether it was reported by a broadsheet or a tabloid. A picture is worth a thousand words. Gian Lorenzo studied several photographs of Angelina and concluded that only Rubens would have considered her as a model. In every picture of Paolo's future bride, no amount of skill displayed by the couturiers of Milan, the stylists of Paris, the jewellers of London, not to mention the legions of personal trainers, dietitians and masseurs, was able to transform her image from sugar plum fairy to prima ballerina. Whichever angle the photographers took, however considerate they tried to be, and some didn't, they only emphasized the transparent difference between her and her fiancé, especially when she stood alongside Roma's former hero. The Italian press, clearly obsessed by Angelina's size, reported nothing else about her of any interest. Gian Lorenzo turned to the arts pages and had quite forgotten about Paolo and his future bride when he strode into the gallery later that morning. As he opened the door to his office, he was greeted by his secretary, who thrust a large gold-embossed card into his hand. Gian Lorenzo glanced down at the invitation. "Signor Massimo Porcelli has pleasure in inviting to the marriage of his daughter Angelina to Signor Paolo Castelli at the Villa Borghese." 6 weeks later, Gian Lorenzo joined 1,000 guests in the grounds of the Villa Borghese. It soon became clear that Signor Porcelli was determined his only child would enjoy a wedding that not only she, but everyone else present would never forget. The setting in the Borghese Gardens, perched on one of the 7 hills overlooking Rome, with its imposing terracotta and cream villa in the background, was the stuff of fairy tales. Gian Lorenzo strolled around the grounds, admiring the sculptures and fountains, while catching up with old friends and contemporaries, some of whom he had not seen since his school days. Some 20 minutes before the ceremony was due to take place, a dozen liveried ushers, in long blue coats trimmed with gold braid and wearing white wigs, moved among the throng. They invited the guests to take their seats in the rose garden as the wedding ceremony was about to commence. Gian Lorenzo joined a large crowd as they made their way towards a recently constructed stand with an elevated semicircle of seats surrounding a raised stage with an altar as its centerpiece. Not unlike a football ground where a different form of worship takes place on a Saturday afternoon. His connoisseur's eye took in the magnificent view over Rome, a scene made even more dazzling by the number of beautiful women dressed in clothes that he suspected had never been worn before, and in some cases would never be worn again. They were complemented by elegantly dressed men in tailcoats and white shirts, with only different coloured ties and cravats to suggest the peacock in them. Gian Lorenzo looked around to find that he was surrounded by leading politicians, captains of industry, actors, socialites, as well as many of Paolo's old teammates. The next actor to take his place on the stage was Paolo himself, accompanied by his best man. Gian Lorenzo knew he was a well-known footballer, but couldn't recall his name. As Paolo strode down the grass path and onto the pitch, Gian Lorenzo understood only too well why women could not take their eyes off the man. Paolo walked up onto the stage, took his place on the right of the altar, and waited to be joined by his bride. A 40-piece string orchestra, almost hidden among the trees behind the altar, struck up the opening chords of Mendelssohn's Wedding March. 1,000 guests rose from their seats and turned to see the bride as she progressed slowly up the thick grass carpet on the arm of her proud father.
"What a beautiful dress," said the lady standing in front of Gian Lorenzo. He nodded his agreement, and, staring at the yards of Persian silk that formed a magnificent train behind Angelina, didn't express the one thought that must have been on everyone's mind. Nevertheless, the look on Angelina's face was that of a bride displaying total contentment with her lot. She was walking towards the man she adored, aware that many of the women present would have been only too happy to take her place. As Angelina climbed the steps up onto the stage, the boards creaked. Her future husband smiled as he took a pace forward to join his bride. They both turned to face Cardinal Montagny, the Archbishop of Naples. One or two guests failed to stifle a smile when the cardinal turned to Paolo and inquired, "Do you take this woman to be your lawful wedded wife, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer?" Once bride and groom had been joined together in holy matrimony, Gian Lorenzo made his way to the long garden to join 1,000 other guests for dinner. A feast followed that began with champagne and truffle risotto and ended with chocolate souffle and a Chateau de Chem. Gian Lorenzo could barely move by the time Paolo rose to reply to his best man's speech. "I am the happiest man on earth," he declared, as he turned to face his beaming bride. "I have found the ideal woman for me, and I am only too aware that I must be the envy of every bachelor present." A sentiment which Gian Lorenzo could not quite agree with, but he quickly banished the ungracious thought from his mind. Paolo continued, "You know, I was the first suitor to win Angelina's heart. No longer will I have to search for the perfect woman because I have found her. Please rise and join me in a toast to Angelina, my little angel." The gathering rose as one and toasted, "Angelina." One or two even managed, "his little angel." After the speeches were over, the dancing began to yet another band, this time one that had been flown in from New Orleans. Gian Lorenzo overheard that Angelina had once mentioned to Papa that she liked jazz. As the band struck up and the champagne continued to flow, the newlyweds moved among their guests, which gave Gian Lorenzo a fleeting moment to thank Paolo and his bride for including him in such an unforgettable occasion. "Medici would have swooned," he told her, as he kissed her hand. She gave him a warm, gentle smile, but didn't respond. "Let's keep in touch," suggested Paolo as the two of them drifted away. "Angelina is fascinated by art, you know, and is thinking of starting her own collection," were the last words Gian Lorenzo heard before Paolo moved on to another guest. Just before the sun rose and breakfast was about to be served, Signor and Signora Castelli set off for the airport, with 1,000 hands waving their farewells. They drove out of the grounds of the Borghese with Paolo at the wheel of his latest Ferrari, not the ideal car for his bride. When they reached the airport, Paolo drove out onto a private airstrip and brought the car to a halt by the side of a Learjet that was waiting for two passengers. The newlyweds left the Ferrari parked on the runway, climbed the steps, and disappeared inside Papa's aircraft. Within minutes of fastening their seatbelts, the jet took off for Acapulco, the first stop on their 3-month honeymoon. Despite Paolo's parting words, when the Castellis returned from their honeymoon, they made no attempt to keep in touch with Gian Lorenzo. However, he was able to follow their exploits on an almost daily basis in the gossip columns of the national press. A year later, he read that they would be moving to Venice, where they had purchased the type of villa that makes the covers, not the inside pages of glossy magazines. Gian Lorenzo assumed that he and his old friend were unlikely to bump into each other again. When Antonio Venici retired, he happily handed over the responsibility for the family business to his son. As the new owner of the Venici Gallery, Gian Lorenzo spent half his time travelling around Europe in search of that elusive painting which makes collectors gasp, while not insulting the dealer with any suggestion of bargaining. One such journey was to Venice, to view a Canaletto owned by the Contessa di Palma,
A lady who, having divorced her third husband, and sadly no longer possessing the looks to guarantee a fourth, had decided she would have to part with one or two of her treasures. The Contessa's only stipulation was that no one must discover that she was facing temporary financial difficulties. Every leading dealer in Italy knew of her mounting debts and unpaid creditors. Gian Lorenzo was only thankful that the Contessa had chosen him to share her confidences with. Gian Lorenzo took some time to study the Contessa's considerable collection and concluded that she had an eye not only for rich men. After he had agreed a price for the Canaletto, he expressed the hope that this might be the beginning of a long and fruitful relationship.
"Let's start with dinner at Harry's bar, my darling," said the Contessa, once she had Gian Lorenzo's check in her hand.
Gian Lorenzo was making up his mind between an affogato or an espresso when Paolo and Angelina strolled into Harry's bar. Everyone in the room followed their progress as the maitre d' ushered them unctuously to a corner table.
"Now there's someone who can afford to buy my entire collection," whispered the Contessa.
"Without a doubt," agreed Gian Lorenzo. "But unfortunately Paolo only collects rare cars."
"And even rarer women," interjected the Contessa.
"And I'm not altogether sure what Angelina collects."
"A few extra pounds each year," suggested the Contessa. "She once came to tea with my second husband and literally ate us out of house and home. By the time she left, we were down to the water biscuits."
"Well, let's try and make up for that tonight," said Gian Lorenzo. "I'm told the zabaglione is their signature dish."
The Contessa showed no interest in the zabaglione, but simply sailed on, ignoring her companion's unsubtle hint.
"Can you imagine what those two get up to when they're in bed?"
Gian Lorenzo was surprised that the Contessa was willing to voice a question he had often thought about, but never felt able to express. And there was worse to come, as the Contessa went on to describe things that hadn't until then even crossed Gian Lorenzo's mind.
"Do you think he climbs on top of her?"
Gian Lorenzo didn't offer an opinion.
"A feat in itself," she continued, "because if they did it the other way around, surely she'd suffocate him."
Gian Lorenzo didn't care to think about the image, so he tried once again to change the subject.
"We went to the same school, you know. One hell of an athlete." "You'd have to be, to satisfy her."
"I even attended their wedding," he added. "A truly memorable occasion, though I doubt after all this time that he would even remember I was among the guests."
"Would you really be willing to spend the rest of your life with such a creature, however much money she had to offer?"
asked the Contessa, not paying attention to her host's words.
"He claims to adore her," said Gian Lorenzo. "Calls her his little angel."
"In that case, I wouldn't want to meet up with his idea of a big angel."
"But if he felt otherwise," suggested Gian Lorenzo, "he could always divorce her."
"Not a chance," said the Contessa. "You clearly haven't been told about their prenuptial agreement."
"No, I haven't,"
admitted Gian Lorenzo, trying not to sound interested.
"Her father had much the same opinion of that clapped-out footballer as I do. Old man Porcelli made him sign an agreement which spelled out that if Paolo ever divorced his daughter, he would end up with nothing. Paolo was also forced to sign a second document stating that he would never reveal the contents of the prenuptial to anyone, including Angelina."
"Then how do you know about it?" prompted Gian Lorenzo.
"When you've signed as many prenuptials as I have, darling, you hear things."
Gian Lorenzo laughed and called for the bill. The maitre d' smiled.
"It's already been taken care of, signor," he said,
nodding in the direction of Paolo,
"by your old school friend."
"How kind of him," said Gian Lorenzo.
"No,
her,"
the Contessa reminded him.
"Please excuse me for a moment," said Gian Lorenzo,
I must just thank them before we leave." He rose from his place and made his way slowly across the crowded room. "How are you?" said Paolo, who was on his feet long before Gian Lorenzo had reached their table. "You know my little angel, of course," he said, turning to smile at his wife. "But then, how could you ever forget?" Gian Lorenzo took Angelina's hand and kissed it gently. "And I will also never forget your magnificent wedding."
"Medici would have swooned," said Angelina.
Gian Lorenzo gave a slight bow in acknowledgement.
"Is that the Contessa di Palma you are dining with?" asked Paolo. "Because if it is, she has something my little angel desires."
Gian Lorenzo made no comment.
"I do hope, Gian Lorenzo, that she's a client, not a friend, because if my little angel wants something, then I will stop at nothing to ensure she gets it."
Gian Lorenzo still considered it wise to remain silent. "Never forget," his father had once told him, "only restaurateurs close deals in restaurants when they hand you the bill."
"And as it's a field I know little about," continued Paolo, "and you are acknowledged as one of the nation's leading authorities, perhaps you would be kind enough to represent Angelina on this occasion."
"I would be delighted to do so,"
said Gian Lorenzo as the head waiter placed a chocolate trifle in front of Paolo's wife, with a bowl of creme fraiche on the side.
"Excellent," said Paolo. "Let's keep in touch."
Gian Lorenzo smiled and shook his old friend by the hand. He well remembered the last occasion Paolo had made such an offer. But then some people consider such suggestions nothing more than polite conversation. Gian Lorenzo turned to Angelina and bowed low before walking back across the restaurant to rejoin the Contessa.
"Time for us to leave, I fear," said Gian Lorenzo, glancing at his watch, "especially if I'm to catch the first plane to Rome in the morning."
"Did you manage to sell my Canaletto to your friend?"
asked the Contessa as she rose from her place.
"No," replied Gian Lorenzo as he waved in the direction of Paolo's table. "But he did suggest that we keep in touch."
"And will you?"
"That might be quite difficult," admitted Gian Lorenzo, "as he didn't give me his number, and I have a feeling Signor and Signora Castelli will not be listed in the yellow pages."
Gian Lorenzo took the first flight back to Rome the following morning. The Canaletto was to follow him at a more leisurely pace. No sooner had he set foot in the gallery than his secretary rushed out of the office, spilling out the words,
"Paolo Castelli has already called twice this morning. He apologized for not giving you his number," she added, "and I wondered if you would be kind enough to phone him just as soon as you get in."
Gian Lorenzo walked calmly into his office, sat down at his desk, and composed himself. He then tapped out the number his secretary had placed in front of him. The call was first answered by a butler, who transferred him to a secretary before he was finally connected to Paolo.
"After you left last night, my little angel spoke of nothing else," began Paolo. "She has never forgotten her visit to the Contessa's home, where she first saw her magnificent art collection. She wondered if the reason you were meeting with the Contessa was..." "I don't think it would be wise to discuss this matter over the phone," said Gian Lorenzo, whose father had also taught him that deals are rarely made on the telephone, but almost always face to face.
"One needs the client to view the picture, and then you allow them to hang it on a wall in their home for several days. There is a crucial moment when the buyer considers the painting already belongs to them. Not until then do you start to negotiate the price."
"Then you'll have to return to Venice," said Paolo, matter-of-factly. "I'll send her the private jet."
Gian Lorenzo flew to Venice the following Friday. The Rolls-Royce was parked on the runway, waiting to take him to the Villa Rosa. A butler greeted Gian Lorenzo at the front door before escorting him up a large marble staircase to a suite of private rooms that exhibited barren walls, an art dealer's fantasy. Gian Lorenzo was reminded of the collection that his father had put together for Agnelli over a period of 30 years, now considered to be one of the finest in private hands. Gian Lorenzo spent most of the Saturday between meals, being escorted round the 142 rooms of the Villa Rosa by Angelina. He quickly discovered that there was far more to his hostess than he had anticipated. Angelina showed a genuine interest in wanting to start her own art collection, and had clearly visited all the great galleries round the world. Gian Lorenzo concluded that she only lacked the courage of her own convictions, a not uncommon problem for the only child of a self-made man, although she didn't lack knowledge or, to Gian Lorenzo's surprise, taste. He felt guilty for making assumptions based only on comments he had read in the press. Gian Lorenzo found himself enjoying Angelina's company, and even began to wonder what this shy, thoughtful young woman could possibly see in Paolo. Over dinner that night, Gian Lorenzo could not miss the adoration in her eyes whenever Angelina looked at her husband, even though she rarely interrupted him. Over breakfast the following morning, Angelina hardly uttered a word. It was not until Paolo suggested that his wife show their guest round the grounds that his little angel once again came alive. Angelina escorted Gian Lorenzo round a 60-acre garden that possessed no immovable objects, or even havens where they might rest to cool their brows. Whenever Gian Lorenzo made a suggestion, she responded with enthusiasm, clearly willing to be led, if only he would take her by the hand. Over dinner that night, it was Paolo who confirmed that it was his little angel's desire to build a great collection in memory of her late father.
"But where to begin?"
asked Paolo, stretching a hand across the table to take his wife's hand.
"Canaletto, perhaps," suggested Gian Lorenzo.
Gian Lorenzo spent the next 5 years commuting between Rome and Venice as he continued to coax pictures out of the Contessa before rehanging them in the Villa Rosa. But as each new gem appeared, Angelina's appetite only became more voracious. Gian Lorenzo found himself having to travel as far afield as America, Russia, and even Colombia, so that he could keep Paolo's little angel satisfied. She seemed determined to outdo Catherine the Great. Angelina became more and more captivated by each new masterpiece Gian Lorenzo put before her. Canaletto, Caravaggio, Tintoretto, Bellini, and Da Vinci were among the natives. Not only did Gian Lorenzo begin to fill up the few remaining places on the walls of the villa, but he also had statues crated and sent from every quarter of the globe to be sited alongside other immigrants on the vast lawn. Moore, Brancusi, Epstein, Miró, Giacometti, and, Angelina's favorite, Botero. With every new purchase she made, Gian Lorenzo presented her with a book about the artist. Angelina would devour them in one sitting and immediately demand more. Gian Lorenzo had to acknowledge that she had become not only the gallery's most important client, but also his most ardent student. What had begun as a flirtation with Canaletto was fast turning into a promiscuous affair with almost all the great masters of Europe. And it was Gian Lorenzo who was expected to continually supply new lovers, something else Angelina had in common with Catherine the Great. Gian Lorenzo was visiting a client in Barcelona, who for tax reasons had to dispose of a Murillo, the birth of Christ, when he heard the news. He considered that the asking price for the painting was too high, even though he knew that Angelina would be willing to pay it. He was in the middle of haggling when his secretary called. Gian Lorenzo took the next available flight back to Rome. Every paper reported, some in great detail, the death of Angelina Castelli. A massive heart attack while she was in her garden trying to move one of the statues. The tabloids, unwilling to mourn the lady for a single day, went on to inform their readers in the second paragraph that she had left her entire fortune to her husband. A photograph of a smiling Paolo, taken long before her death, ran alongside the story. 4 days later, Gian Lorenzo flew to Venice to attend the funeral. The little chapel in the grounds of the Villa Rosa was packed with Angelina's family and friends, some of whom Gian Lorenzo hadn't seen since the wedding celebration, a generation before. When the 6 pallbearers carried the coffin into the chapel, and lowered it gently on a bier in front of the altar. Paolo broke down and sobbed. After the service was over, Gian Lorenzo offered his condolences, and Paolo assured him that he had enriched Angelina's life beyond recompense. He went on to say that he intended to continue building the collection in her memory. "It is no more than my little angel would have wanted," he explained. "So it must be done." Paolo didn't get in touch with him again. Gian Lorenzo was about to dip a spoon into a pot of Oxford marmalade, another habit he had acquired from his father, when he saw the headline. The spoon remained lodged in the marmalade while he read the words a second time. He wanted to be sure that he hadn't misunderstood the headline. Paolo was back on the front page, declaring it was "Love at First Sight." Turn to page 22 for details. Gian Lorenzo quickly flicked through the pages to a column he rarely troubled himself with, "Gossip, Roma, we give you the truth behind the stories." Paolo Castelli, former captain of Roma and the 9th richest man in Italy, is to marry again only 4 years after the death of his little angel. "There's more to her than meets the eye," declared the headline. The paper went on to assure its readers that there couldn't be a bigger contrast between his first wife, Angelina, a billionaireess, and Gina, a 24-year-old waitress from Naples and the daughter of a tax inspector. Gian Lorenzo chuckled when he saw Gina's photograph, aware that many of Paolo's friends wouldn't be able to resist teasing him. Every morning, Gian Lorenzo found himself turning to Gossip Roma in the hope of learning some new titbit about the forthcoming marriage. The wedding, it seemed, would be held in the chapel of the Villa Rosa, which only had enough space to seat a mere 200, so the guests would be restricted to close family and friends. The bride could no longer leave her little home without being pursued by a legion of paparazzi. The groom, they informed their readers, had returned to the gym in the hope of losing a few pounds before the ceremony took place. But the biggest surprise for Gian Lorenzo came when Gossip Roma claimed, in an exclusive, that Signor Gian Lorenzo Venici, Roma's leading art dealer and old school chum of Paolo, would be among the fortunate guests. An invitation arrived in the Morning Post the following day. Gian Lorenzo flew into Venice on the evening before the ceremony and checked into the Hotel Cipriani. He decided a light meal and an early night might perhaps be wise when he thought about the previous wedding. Gian Lorenzo rose early the following morning and took some time dressing for the occasion. Despite this, he still arrived at the Villa Rosa long before the service was due to commence. He wished to stroll among the statues that littered the lawn and become reacquainted with some old friends. Donatello smiled down on him. Moore looked regal. Miro made him laugh, and Giacometti stood tall and thin, but his favourite remained the fountain which graced the centre of the lawn. 10 years before, he had removed each piece of the fountain stone by stone, statue by statue, from a courtyard in Milan. Bellini's The Escaping Hunter looked even more magnificent in its new surroundings. It gave Gian Lorenzo particular pleasure to see how many other guests had also arrived early, clearly with the same thought in mind. A single usher in a smart, dark suit walked among the guests, suggesting that they might like to make their way to the chapel as the ceremony was about to begin. Gian Lorenzo was one of the first to heed his advice, as he wanted to be well-placed to watch the bride make her entrance. Gian Lorenzo found a vacant seat on the aisle about halfway back that would allow him an uninterrupted view of the proceedings. He could see the little choir in their stalls, already singing Vespers, accompanied by a string quartet. At 3:05, Paolo and his best man entered the chapel and walked slowly down the aisle. Gian Lorenzo knew he'd been a well-known footballer, but he still couldn't remember his name. They both took their places by the side of the altar, while Paolo waited for his young bride to appear. Paolo looked fit, tanned and trim, and Gian Lorenzo noted that women still stared at him with adoring eyes. Paolo didn't notice them, and a grin that would have excited comment from Lewis Carroll never left the bridegroom's face. There was a buzz of expectation as the string quartet struck up the opening chords of the wedding march to herald the entrance of the bride. The young woman walked slowly down the aisle on the arm of her father and drew intakes of breath as she passed each new row. Gian Lorenzo could hear her approaching, so he turned to look at Gina for the first time. How would he respond when asked to describe the bride to someone who hadn't been invited to the ceremony? Should he emphasize her beautiful, long, thick, raven hair? Or possibly comment on the smooth, olive texture of her skin, or even add some remark about the magnificent wedding dress that he remembered so well?